This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with the author of graphic novel titled The U.S. versus Private Chelsea Manning.
No TV or radio was allowed in the long months of Chelsea Manning's trial, but Clark Stokely was, and his sketches bring home to you in the most vivid way the words and the pictures that made up the trial, or what I would call the lynching, of Chelsea Manning.
Attorney Matt Wood from Free Press gives us an update on net neutrality and what's happening with the FCC.
Net neutrality means that big, rich companies like Google and others are going to get a faster way to deliver to you their movies, their search engines, etc. The rest of us, who are publishing through all kinds of alternate publications, media, etc., are going to have a slower, much slower way to get you information. Is this fair, or are we just continuing the 1%, the 99% that has molded the last 100 years of this country?
Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Well, a number of articles, or two of them really in particular, came out in the new magazine, The Intercept. That's the one that was founded by Glenn Greenwald, Laura Poitras, Jeremy Scahill, etc. It's part of First Look, the Omidyar piece, to supposedly publish material that other media won't publish. Well, the first big story that came out was about wiretapping or surveillance on five countries. Four of those countries, Mexico, Kenya, Philippines, and the Bahamas, were named. In three of those countries, Mexico, Kenya, and Philippines, the manner of surveillance was one called Mystic. That we're familiar with because that's where you take in all the metadata of people in those countries, where they made the call from, who they're going to, how long the phone call is, but not necessarily take in the content. In the fourth country that Greenwald and others mentioned, it was the Bahamas. Bahamas, which are this chain of islands off the coast of the United States, originally British, have Mystic, but they also have another program called Some I'll Get, S-O-M-A-L-G-E-T. Sounds pretty funny, Some I'll Get. But the Some I'll Get program, which is part of Mystic, takes in the content of every single call in the Bahamas. Let me say that again. Every single call made in and out of the Bahamas or in the Bahamas is taken in by this program, Some I'll Get. It's held for 30 days. The content, this is our NSA doing this, the content is held for 30 days, and they can check it for whenever they want. So people are pretty outraged by that. What is it? There's terrorism in the Bahamas all of a sudden? What's going on here? Why are they doing this to the Bahamas? Well, it's partly experimental, I think, to see what they can do in getting every single phone call. What's interesting is it came in through an illegal back door. It's not that the Bahamas authorized this. It's that oftentimes countries in the world, whether the Bahamas or others, authorize the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration, to go into their phone system, but targeted to getting at DEA, drug enforcement.
Without users' knowledge, obviously.
But this time they went into the DEA structure, they put what are called backdoors in, and they had access to every single phone call and recorded every single phone call in the Bahamas. That's quite a good story. The story mentioned the people who vacationed in the Bahamas, Oprah Winfrey, and others like that. It means they were picking up all the phone conversations of tourists who went there. Then there became what was called a Twitter storm within a day of that. And it was between my client, Julian Assange and WikiLeaks on the one side, and really First Look Intercept on the other side, with Glenn and Julian going back and forth on this issue. Julian's objection was, why didn't they mention the fifth country that had a wide intercept like the Bahamas? In other words, there's a fifth country out there in which the NSA has taken in everything, and they did not mention the name of that country.
Which country is that, Michael?
We don't know that country yet.
I see.
And what they said, the reason Glenn Greenwald says he didn't say that is that, and he said he and others agreed, is that people would be injured as a result of telling what that fifth country was that was being broadly surveilled, and that he didn't want people injured. They did publish four out of the five countries, but not the fifth. The Washington Post, on the other hand, published none of the countries. So you have a step forward in Greenwald publishing four of the five. What they said is it had specific credible concerns that could lead to increased violence. Assange went after them. And I'll read you some of the tweets. It is not the place of first look to decide how a people will choose to act against mass breaches of surveillance by the United States, of their privacy by the United States. He says, who is first look to decide that? Isn't it the people of the country to decide that? It goes on. WikiLeaks tweeting, if a nation wants to engage in a revolt, I want to repeat that. This is WikiLeaks, not necessarily Assange, but WikiLeaks. If a nation wants to engage in a revolt on the basis that the U.S. government is recording all their phone calls, that is their right. WikiLeaks goes on again. When has true published information harmed innocence? You, speaking of Intercept and perhaps Glenn Greenwald, you are painting future publications into a corner with this Pentagon line. Glenn Greenwald responding, but there was a very high convincing probability in that fifth country for which how innocent people would die, which we all accepted. WikiLeaks comes back. We will reveal the name of that censored country whose population is being mass recorded in 72 hours. Now, Greenwald comes back. It's based on a particular physical vulnerabilities of the small company involved. WikiLeaks' final note on this, or perhaps final, an entire people are being victimized. Small abusive company does not eclipse a nation. At most, can be warned pre-publication. I would say, looking at that, that WikiLeaks has the right position. That if you're worried about that some small company in that country that's being massively surveilled, that's in jeopardy, that company can be warned if you want to save those people. But in this case, First Look didn't just simply censor the name of that country. WikiLeaks is saying that's outrageous. It's up to the people of that country. Who are we, Western Northerners, to decide what the people in that country ought to know? And with that, I would have to say I agree with WikiLeaks. Discussion here among my comrades.
Michael, what kind of possible harm are we talking about to the persons in those countries?
It sounds to me like there was a small company probably carrying out some of the surveillance in that company. Mm. And you could, I don't know the answer because I haven't talked to WikiLeaks, but that they're delaying 72 hours to make sure that company can get out. If it happened that Greenwald simply accepted or those people accepted the line of the Pentagon, this company will be in danger, you can't do it. Why wouldn't it have come up to them, just get rid of the company, get the company out of there? But it does seem to me that when the U.S. is imposing something that people in a country are very opposed to and want to revolt against, it's very first worldy to be able to say, we should determine those people in perhaps it's a third world country or a global south country, we should be able to determine that they can't hear it and decide for themselves. Right. I find that to be a bad answer. It's not for whether it's me or Glenn or
others. It's paternalistic to make that determination.
It's arguably paternalistic. It's imperialist. It's perhaps there's race issues. So I gather that what even WikiLeaks is saying, if people are going to be slaughtered the day that information comes out, yeah, you may want to do something to get that group of people out of there. But you certainly don't want to just let those people not know what's going on.
The people who would be targeted and who would be slaughtered, what were they doing and for whom?
Well, my guess is they were doing it for the United States and they were engaging in broad surveillance. And so then it's up to the United States to protect them. And they've known about the Snowden revelations for 6 months now. So if they've known about them for 6 months now, they should get in there and protect their people and get them out because it's only a matter of time when it's coming out. You know, I don't think the justifications of First Look were sufficient to overcome the objections of WikiLeaks. That information ought to get out.
Hey, y'all, I got a story I want to tell somebody.
my life I've seen a lot of things.
Last year, our own Michael Ratner made many trips from New York City to Fort Meade, Maryland, to attend the secretive Chelsea Manning trials. Michael heard Chelsea testify as to why she released each set of documents, such as the Iraq war logs, the Afghanistan war logs, State Department cables, and more. She said she did it as an act of conscience. Our guest WikiLeaks activist and artist Clark Steckley was also at this historic trial. His recent graphic novel titled The United States versus Private Chelsea Manning is a collection of his vivid sketches from inside the courtroom. He joins us to talk about his work and his experiences producing the book.
We're pleased to be speaking with Clark Steckley today. Clark in particular, covered the Bradley Manning trial day in and day out. Clark is a renowned sketch artist and has just published a book on the Manning trial. And what's the name of that book, Clark?
It's The United States versus Private Chelsea Manning. With the subtitle, A Graphic Account from Inside the Courtroom.
And who published it?
It's by O.R. Books.
And it contains hand sketches by you in ink, right?
Correct, ink and colored pencil.
And on one page you'll see the sketch, and on the other page or underneath you'll see an explanation of the sketch.
Correct, and as well as all of the speech bubbles are directly taken from either Alexa O'Brien's pretrial transcripts that she wrote, or the Freedom of the Press Foundation crowdfunded stenographer's transcript. As I understand it, the official transcripts are still under seal.
Yeah, and when I looked at the book, and of course I was at the trial for part of it and saw you doing the sketching, the book is an extraordinary way to gain accessibility to what happened at that trial, to the images of the trial, which most people never saw because there's no way that media was allowed in there, and, of course, to the words of the trial, because many people don't read the transcripts. So I thought it was quite an accomplishment. Before I go into some of that, how long did it take you, for example, to do a sketch? Let's say Chelsea Manning talking about why she wants the American public to know what is going on in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Those sketches took a little bit longer. Ones that were a full courtroom where I drew a lot of people took a long time. And the way I worked was I would work in pencil first and draw as quickly as I could everything that I saw in the courtroom. And then I would come back and fill it in with color and a hard outline in ink and then colored pencil. And so that process often would take months later. With over 300 drawings, about 250 in the book, I lost track. It's tens of thousands of hours.
Here's one. There's one of Chelsea Manning, a pen and ink portrait of Chelsea Manning. I wanted the American public to know that not everyone in Iraq and Afghanistan are targets that needed to be neutralized, but rather people who were struggling to live by the pressure cooker environment of what we call asymmetric warfare. After the release, this is still Chelsea speaking, I was encouraged by the response in the media and the general public who observed the aerial weapons team video. As I hoped, others were just as troubled, if not more troubled.
Tell us what Chelsea meant by the video of the helicopter gunship.
On that particular day, that was February 28th of 2013, the most courageous event I've ever seen in my life, because Chelsea didn't have to plea at that point. And what she was doing was essentially offering up to 20 years of her life, accepting full responsibility. And that takes a lot of courage and bravery to do that. And being the smallest person in the courtroom, being noble about it and not trying to lie, because that's what she is a truth teller. It was an amazing day, a 35-page statement that lasted about 70 minutes. And, you know, there was a leaked audio of that. And that was the pinnacle point and moment in the trial. And that happened in the pretrial. And unfortunately, a lot of the media wasn't there to really catch trial because they only showed up on the first day in the big, you know, the sentencing and the verdict. That's essentially where the appeal is going to happen, is everything that happened in the pretrial. And I think that's what we're going to be talking about. Vincent Ward and Nancy Hollander will be arguing is the pretrial punishment that Chelsea received at Quantico, as well as the lack of speedy trial, unlawful command influence, and overclassification. The trial section, what happened last summer, is going to be the lesser element of the appeal, as I understand it.
I'm looking at your stunning visuals. One in particular is disturbing. The caption says, "Later, in a particularly disturbing manner, the aerial weapons team crew verbalizes enjoyment at the sight of one of the U.S. military ground vehicles driving over a body, one of the bodies." You have a blurb of one of them saying it's their fault for bringing their kids into a battle. Were some of the images especially difficult for you to render, or do some resonate with you?
Well, you know, I was really stunned on April 5th of 2010 when I first saw the video. It resonated with me then, and I became somewhat desensitized to it. I did a performance once where I spent 24 hours in a jail cell with Collateral Murder playing on repeat, and that certainly did. But the most visceral experience in the courtroom was definitely the times when Collateral Murder was playing on nearly five screens, a large projection screen and monitors on tables, and as well as in hanging from the ceiling, and hearing the sounds echo through this really small courtroom that had acoustics that only amplified the gunshots and the what you would hear the gunners and the pilots saying in that video. So, but I wanted to capture that both in how Manning talks about it, as well as, it comes up again in the opening of the defense's argument, and again in their closing argument. So, that's the most visual of the stuff that Manning leaked. I don't know. I remember how the courtroom just fell to a complete silence when that video came on, and afterwards, and the tears and the blank stares on the prosecution's faces. I did everything I could to capture as quickly as I could.
There was another drawing you made, which was of Camp Delta at Guantanamo, and then a drawing of Obama and what his speech had said. And I recall being in the courtroom when this occurred. And Chelsea Manning had said he recalled that in early 2009, Barack Obama stated that he would close Guantanamo, and that the facility compromised our standing all over the world and diminished our moral authority. Of course, as we speak today, it's still open. And then what Chelsea went on to say under your drawing of Camp Delta at Guantanamo was, "I have always understood the need to detain and interrogate individuals who might wish to harm the United States. I felt that's what we were trying to do at Guantanamo. However, the more I became educated on the topic, it seems we found ourselves holding an increasing number of individuals indefinitely that we knew to be innocent, low-level foot soldiers that did not have useful intelligence." So that was another part of Chelsea's reasons for coming public, because of her belief that we were really picking up people willy-nilly, taking them to Guantanamo, and holding them indefinitely. And your drawings of both Obama and Camp Delta, I think, capture that extremely well.
Well, thank you. Yes. OR book encouraged me to draw things, that were not in the courtroom. And I'm glad they did, because it makes the visuals come together with the words that she spoke. And, actually, as I'm looking through the book right now, I see you... you're in the picture there, Michael, in the background, sitting behind Chelsea.
That must be a dot.
We're speaking with Clark Stokely, who wrote the book. It's a graphic novel, wrote and sketched, The United States versus Private Chelsea Manning. Clark, what's been the reception to this book? Is it helping to publicize Chelsea's situation? She got, how many years did she get in prison?
35 was the sentence. You know, that's going to be appealed. In 7 years, you know, they would be looking at a parole option. But as I understand, the appeal will start at the earliest in December, but possibly, you know, more likely in February or March of next year. And so I'm looking forward to that. I'm curious, Michael, like what kind of steps going forward, Michael Ratner, I mean, can we go to get all of the court filings and all of the transcripts from this trial, the official one?
Yeah. Alex O'Brien, who was a journalist who covered this extensively, and there were only three, and you have a nice picture of the three. There was Alexa, Kevin Gazzala, and who was the third one? Was
Adam Klassel.
Adam Klassel.
And Nathan Fuller's.
Nathan also was there.
Yeah.
So very little coverage. As you know, Alexa has been tenacious about getting every piece of paper. The Center for Constitutional Rights had to file a lawsuit in which they said they were giving us all the papers. We've been making reports back and forth as to whether that's true. So it's really Alexa who has stayed on top of what papers were missing and what papers we're trying to get. Hopefully we'll get more, and as the appeal goes on, we'll get them all. But I'm not sure. It was, as you know, and as some of our listeners know, it was not easy getting any papers out of that court. Even ones that weren't secret were not given to us, and we had to file a lawsuit to get what should be public papers, and that took us almost a year to the end of the trial.
And what kind of, you know, they kind of gave us in that lawsuit, what was the end verdict?
The end verdict is that we're entitled to all the papers unless they're classified, and then they have to go through a classification review. So it's inexcusable that we don't have our hands on every sheet of paper. Alexa's website, under Alexa O'Brien, but you have to, you know a little bit about navigation, but with some work you can get through it, and you'll find most of the papers that are there from the Chelsea Manning trial. Another picture I wanted to draw to people's attention, there's a picture, I think it also appears in the book, it's about a dozen of the spectators in the room. They're all wearing black shirts, and the word truth is on those shirts, except the word truth is inside out, and I'm not sure you could actually see it inside out. But as you say in your caption, observers in the courtroom with T-shirts bearing the word, quote, truth, which they have been required by court officials to wear inside out.
Right.
So
I felt that was one of the most symbolic moments of the trial. You know, really the turning truth inside out. I think that was part of the plan, because prior to the truth shirts appearing in the courtroom, spectators were not allowed to wear any kind of support T-shirts in any way. And this happened, that particular day was the first day of the trial. And I pressed the PR, or the public affairs people, for the Army as to why that had happened. And I also pointed out kind of the irony of doing that and suggested to them that they change it. And so by the next day, they had allowed people to wear the truth shirts again. The truth brigade was allowed to join them. And the PR guy was, or the what they called the legal matter expert, he said it was some new guards had just decided that was the best thing to do. And who knows? But it was quite a tense environment down there, both in the press room and in the courtroom. And then that was one of the times. But you know, they did not like that we were holding vigils every week and had large protests there that kind of shut down the road, and they had to reroute traffic. And it was the largest protest that Fort Meade had ever seen. And so it was definitely tough, because they had a WikiLeaks truck driving around on NSA headquarters, and they couldn't do anything about it.
Clark, we just have a minute or so left. Okay. I wanted to ask, do you know if Chelsea Manning has seen your book?
OR Books has sent a copy, and that's the only way that it could happen, is it had to be sent directly from the publisher. So I wasn't able to sign it or leave a note in it. But just a heads up to anyone who wants to correspond with Chelsea, you now have to use the name Chelsea when addressing envelopes to her. So,
who do you write to, Clark? What's the address? Do you know?
It's on the chelseamanning.org website. I don't have the exact address in front of me right now.
Clark, your book is called The United States versus Private Chelsea Manning. It's a graphic novel published by OR Books. I wanted to ask you, is it being distributed so that people can learn more about this and come to her defense?
Yeah, we're trying to get as many people to read it as possible. That's my goal, I just started putting them in libraries today, and also I've had teachers and also professors, lawyers, and several other people. We're trying to get the word out, and I think this is a way that people can catch up on what happened who weren't able to be there. In one sitting and really kind of get an understanding of the environment and tone and feel, as well as, the most interesting points and moments of this trial.
A lot of our listeners may not know, but every day you went to the trial, you drew up in that big WikiLeaks white truck with the hourglass on the side and the big word WikiLeaks. What is it called? WikiLeaks? It's
Top Secret Mobile Information Collection Unit.
Right, yeah. So you're standing there at Fort Meade with a line of cars, of like 40 or 50 cars of journalists and others, and you have this big truck that has that logo on the side, WikiLeaks.
Top Secret Mobile Information Collection Unit.
Well, it was also at Occupy for a while here in New York.
Yeah.
So it's one of my favorite trucks in the world. And as our famous cartoon from the 60s always said, Stokely.
Keep on trucking.
Exactly. Keep on trucking.
You know, Clark, or Michael Ratner and I did a book on how the CIA assassinated Che, and it was published by OR Books also. And,
oh, right.
But our listeners should know, OR Books is an unusual publisher because it doesn't stock books in bookstores. If you want to find out what books they publish, particularly yours, you got to go online. So that's
right.
How you can get The United States versus Private Chelsea Manning, OR Books.
Or if you are a bookstore, you can buy them from them at a wholesale price.
Yes, and then they can stock them.
We were set up at the Anarchist Book Fair this weekend, and several independent bookstores came in and are now selling the book as well.
Excellent.
Their model is really ideal for sustainability and staying true to my activist ideals.
Where is Chelsea in prison now?
She's in Leavenworth, at Fort Leavenworth. There has been a leaked document stating that the Army might want to transfer her to a civilian prison so that she can get hormone treatment therapy. Chelsea doesn't want to go to a civilian prison. That's the most recent update going on with this.
Okay.
And she has officially got her name changed.
I want to thank you for both staying through the trial, doing the incredible drawings, getting them public, keeping us up to date. So thank you, Clark.
Thank you so much, Michael. Appreciate having
you. It was great.
Thank you very
Bye, Clark.
Much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org. In our last interview with attorney Matt Wood, policy director at Free Press, we talked about the $45 billion Comcast-Time Warner merger and its implications for net neutrality. The proposed merger would unite the nation's largest cable TV and internet service provider with the second largest cable company. If combined, these businesses would offer service to two-thirds of U.S. households. We get an update on the merger, and we also discuss the new rules proposed by the FCC to reclassify broadband into a Title II public utility. Here to discuss both issues is Free Press Policy Director Matt Wood. Welcome back to Law and Disorder, Matt.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So it's been a busy time for the issue of net neutrality. It's in the news every day. Tell us what's happening down in D.C.
Yeah, it has been in the news every day. There was sort of not an end point, but a starting point for the proceeding that will be going on for the rest of the summer last week when Federal Communications Commission had a meeting and voted on a new proposal for rules to try and address what happened in the D.C. Circuit back in January. Basically, that court said for the second time that net neutrality might be a good policy. In fact, went so far as to say in the January opinion that it is a good policy, or at least that the FCC's case about it was solid, just that the legal authority the FCC had used to try and adopt rules protecting the open internet was no good. And so what the court said was you can't treat broadband providers as common carriers, not as some sort of insurmountable conclusion, but simply based on the way the FCC has decided to treat them up to this point. So the FCC has, over the past decade or so, tried to deregulate and yet tried to maintain some of the protections that we all need from our communications
Explain
providers.
To me, I'm sorry to interrupt, but when you use that phrase,
The
ruling was that they couldn't treat internet as common carriers. I'm not following. Can you unpack that a little? I don't know what that means.
Sure, sure. So, you know, people are familiar with their telephone service, and I think mostly understand that telephone service is regulated. That doesn't mean that that the government regulates what you and I say to each other on the phone, but it means that there is some sort of protection on the phone line that requires the phone company to carry our traffic without interference. And that's this age-old doctrine of common carrier status that applies not just to telecommunication services, but has applied to telecom for the last century. The FCC in 2002, when it came to look at broadband, especially at that point, broadband as offered by cable companies, decided, okay, we're not going to treat broadband services as common carrier services. Yet, we're still going to require broadband to stay open. And when I say open, I mean, you know, prevent broadband providers from blocking anyone, prevent them from discriminating unreasonably against any website or any user or any speaker. And what the D.C. Circuit has now twice said is basically, FCC, you can't have it both ways. Now, they've left it to the FCC's discretion to decide whether broadband is a common carrier service or not. And that was blessed by the Supreme Court back in 2005 in a Chevron case where the Supreme Court says, yes, this is up to the FCC to decide. There was a dissent there, and Justice Scalia, of all people, thought that it wasn't in the FCC's discretion. He thinks that broadband clearly should be a common carrier, at least if we go back 10 years to that decision. But though it's in the FCC's discretion, according to the majority and according to the D.C. Circuit, what the courts have said is the FCC has made this decision in the past. They still haven't reversed it. You know, they still want to say that broadband is not a common carrier service, and therefore the FCC can't adopt common carrier or common carrier-like obligations for broadband, having made that initial classification decision and left it as it stands right now.
Now, Matt, I understand that some Democrats, such as Henry Waxman and Ed Markey, have asked that the FCC consider reclassifying broadband as a utility. Is that the same thing as common carrier? Is that different?
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of all around it. Utility is sort of a loaded term. And sometimes people on the opposite side of this debate who don't think net neutrality is a good idea, chiefly the broadband providers themselves and some members of Congress, would say, well, it's not a utility. What are you talking about? There's more than one choice that we have for broadband. I would just note that utility or monopoly are both pretty precise terms in the law, and you can treat somebody as a common carrier without them being a monopoly or a utility in the first place. The example I usually go to here is cell phone providers. You know, there's more than one of those, AT&T, Verizon, Sprint, T-Mobile, maybe a few others depending on where you live. Yet it would still seem outlandish to most people if they were told, well, AT&T wireless is not going to complete your calls anymore to certain numbers because, hey, if you don't like it, you can always switch to Verizon. Now, that's the kind of protection we're talking about here, making sure that we do have these common carrier protections that apply to everyone from airlines and parcel shippers and even retail stores in some ways, if we're talking about just kind of basic non-discrimination protections that are not reserved only for utilities or only for monopolies, even if these common carrier kind of obligations would indeed apply to such utilities and monopolies.
I read an article called The Net Neutrality Hysteria by John Dvorak in PC Magazine recently, and it made me look at this whole issue from a slightly different perspective. He claims that one of the principles listed in the hearing proposals adopted by the FCC are the words legal content. And he asks who's going to decide what is legal and what isn't. And in differing from what many people are claiming that, you know, corporations are going to go out of their way to create different tiers of access and speed, he says that if the FCC rules were in place, we wouldn't have, for example, heard of Ed Snowden because the files would have been deemed illegal. So he's saying that it's not necessarily the corporations we should be concerned about, but it's government. What would you say in response to that?
Well, I'd say I don't really buy his argument because what the lawful content connotation does here is not say anything like the phone companies have to be in service of the government. It just says that you can't come to the FCC and say, well, you know, I'm infringing on somebody's copyright, but there's no way anybody in the world can stop me because the phone company has to carry my traffic without discrimination, without interference. I'm not trying to dismiss his argument. There's obviously a grave concern about government secrecy and censorship, especially when it comes to whistleblowers and the kind of information that Edward Snowden brought to all of us. But again, I think telephone analogies are not always sufficient, but they're instructive anyway. And what I would compare this to is, you know, the notion that if you use the phone to commit a crime, whether that is wire fraud or just, you know, you're talking to your co-conspirators about how to conduct the crime, it is not the telephone company's place to step in and either say you can or can't make that call. So net neutrality is a way of ensuring that the carrier of our speech, that's typically a private company, cable or phone company, doesn't have a role in deciding whether or not that speech goes through. Now, if and when the government wants to step in and say, hey, we want to tap that line because we're actually conducting an investigation, or if and when there's a punishment for the activity that you use the phone to plan, that's obviously a very important legal debate and one I don't mean to minimize. It's just that, you know, net neutrality is not a way for the government to control our speech. It is a way to ensure that the cable and phone companies do not control our speech. And it's our protection against those private entities, nothing that answers the important question he's asking about censorship or protections for whistleblowers.
Matt, my understanding of net neutrality is simply that everybody should be treated equal, and if that the big corporations can muscle their way in, they can use the net at a faster pace than anybody else, which would prejudice other users. And my question to you is, if that happens, and there are, let's say, two different highways on the net rather than one now, how does that impact schools, say, and libraries, or even programs like Law and Disorder, which is on the net? Would we be at a disadvantage? Would schools and libraries be at a disadvantage?
Yeah, I think certainly at a disadvantage, and the impact would be a negative one. The FCC in its current mode is basically saying, well, even if we're required to allow these two tiers or really multiple tiers of service, we can still step in and protect you and provide a basic level of service. Now, I think even that is subject to question because there are both technical questions and legal questions about whether they could do that absent reclassifying. But even if they did, you know, the notion that somehow we can lock into place today a basic level of service and everything above that is just gravy, I think is not a very forward-looking kind of thesis. The notion that, you know, we've basically arrived at the level of broadband speed necessary to carry Law and Disorder or to carry educational content, and that what we have today is good enough or only needs to evolve at a certain slow pace, is a dangerous one. And I think the question about educational institutions really lays bare another fundamental fallacy in the arguments that some net neutrality opponents make, which is that, well, really, this is just all about Netflix and Google trying to get a free ride on the internet service providers' lines, on the wires of Comcast or AT&T or Verizon. That claim in and of itself is not true, and I'm happy to talk more about why that is. But even more important, perhaps, is that this isn't just about, you know, big internet companies on one side and big telephone and cable companies on the other side. It's about the fact that we all use the internet, and especially in a cloud-based system more and more. You know, we're using it not just to watch movies, which is an important cultural activity, but to back up our files and to send educational videos around the internet and to reach students in new places. In other words, it's not as if the only high bandwidth use of the internet is a commercial one and one for entertainment purposes, but we're using it more and more for all sorts of economic and educational and civic and political discourse. And that's why it's so important to make sure that everybody has roughly the same chance of using it. It's okay for different people to pay different amounts to increase their own capacity and their own speed. You know, no one is saying that buying more speed from your internet service provider for your connection is somehow illegitimate. What the cable and telephone companies want to do is they want to charge you extra to reach their customers, and they want to charge in both directions. So rather than just saying, my broadband customers can pay for different levels of speed, they'll say, and if you want to reach them at all, Netflix or Google or Law and Disorder, or, you know, an educational institution, you also have to pay us now.
That scares me. And let me tell you another thing that scares me is the revolving door between the FCC and the industry. And I wanted to ask you about that.
Yeah, it's a good question and a tough one to answer. I mean, it's no secret that Chairman Wheeler headed not just one but two telecommunications lobbies. At one point, he was the head of the Cable Lobbying Association, and then later on, the Wireless Association. We here at Free Press have tried to be as forthright about this as we can be, which is to say, you know, not to judge him based on his resume in advance, not to prejudge him, but also not to ignore the fact that this is where a lot of his thinking about these industries was formed. And, you know, I don't know that you can draw a line and say, aha, you know, here is the cable industry veteran who's adopting or proposing to adopt a certain kind of rules. But, you know, it's a larger question than just this one single person who happens to sit in the chairman's seat right now. And I think it's a good question about, you know, is there something that sort of requires a certain level of technical expertise that is typically going to come from working for the industry before you can go into government service in this field? Or should we have a broader view and a bigger horizon for the kinds of people who should be put into these decision-making jobs?
Yeah, exactly. Now, I'm going to just ask you one last thing. This is the third thing that scares me, and that's the mergers that are going on. The first one a little while ago between Time Warner and Comcast. There's another one talking about now with DirecTV. That scares me, too. What do you think of that?
Yeah, we're definitely out there trying to, if not scare people, then certainly let them know what's happening and tell them why this is such a bad idea. I mean, a lot of these issues inside of D.C. have become kind of partisan, and that's unfortunate because it's just not a partisan issue when you really sit down and think about it. When you have fewer and fewer companies who control everything that we can see and say to each other, you have a tremendous loss in diversity of viewpoint. Everything kind of, you know, gets pushed towards a single viewpoint or towards the middle, whatever that means. And when Free Press, when our organization was founded back in 2003, there was a lot of concern across the political spectrum about media consolidation and about gatekeeper power and basically eliminating multiple voices in favor of one or two. I think we're seeing a little bit of that return because of Comcast's reputation and MSNBC's reputation as more of a Democratic-leaning news operation. You know, to quote the old line, not that there's anything wrong with that, but, you know, there are some people on the Republican side of the aisle who are saying, well, wait a minute, you know, this doesn't sound like a good idea to us to have one big company who is predisposed to oppose us controlling more and more of the channels that we can see and more of our communications paths to each other. And that might be a little bit self-serving or hypocritical in some ways, but in another way, I'm glad that people are waking up to the dangers of such massive consolidation again, not only to a particular set of speakers or a particular party, but to all speakers, because we all lose out when we lose out on this multiplicity of voices you need in a democracy.
You mentioned free press. Can you tell us a bit about your mission and what other issues you're working on?
Sure. I mean, those are two of the biggest ones right now. But we are a nationwide, nonpartisan, nonprofit organization with more than 700,000 members in the U.S. and around the world, people that we send emails to and get them to, you know, sign petitions. But beyond that, that we also have actually speaking to their elected representatives directly by calling them or by doing meetings back at home when their members of Congress are in their districts. We try to do that to not only be part of the conversation here in Washington, D.C., but get real people's voices back into that conversation so that it's not just a battle of lobbyists, but that it is really a place where the public can come and have a voice in these decisions that affect the public interest. And we work on a pretty broad swath of media and technology issues, including everything from these internet access questions, like net neutrality, to the telecom and media mergers we were just talking about with AT&T and Comcast looking to get bigger and bigger, to broadcast issues as well, because for all of the talk about local broadcasting and over-the-air TV broadcasting in particular being a thing of the past, it really is still the primary news source for a lot of people and one of the only ways people can get local news, other than maybe a local newspaper, if those are not even worse off at this point. So that and things like surveillance and the Snowden revelations that you mentioned a while ago, kind of the full gamut of internet freedom and press freedom issues, as we call them, that we try to occupy ourselves with and keep people informed about as well.
If our listeners want to get involved in helping to ensure net neutrality, there's obviously your website. What other, and there's been actions, I know people have sent letters to the FCC, et cetera, but in terms of where we are right now, what are some of the best actions that can be taken by our listeners, by organizations, et cetera, who are out there?
Sure, yeah. We have our website at freepress.net, and we have another one that we help to run, which is called savetheinternet.com, which is even more action-oriented and focused on net neutrality right now in particular. At our Free Press website, you can find information about net neutrality, but also all the other campaigns that we run. Right now, I think it is targeted, but also sort of an all-of-the-above strategy, which is to say, as I mentioned at the top, the FCC has this proceeding that they'll be running over the summer. What Chairman Wheeler has proposed to this point, we think, is not good enough, but it's not a done deal yet either, and so the FCC will take comments not only from companies and from groups like ours, but from members of the public. And you can find out from our website how to participate in that process, to send your thoughts to the FCC. Talking to members of Congress is also important because, well, there's really no prospect of Congress legislating on this topic in the very near future. What they say to the FCC and about the FCC matters and helps to shape the conversation at the agency. In fact, just yesterday, Chairman Wheeler was in front of the House Energy and Commerce Committee's Telecom Subcommittee, which is the committee of jurisdiction over the Federal Communications Commission. So that is very, very much an ongoing dialogue between the agency and the members of Congress who oversee that agency. And then there's also a role here for the White House. You know, because the FCC is a creature of Congress and an independent agency from the White House, it's difficult, if not impossible, for President Obama to say, do this, Tom Wheeler, here's what I want you to do at the FCC. But of course, President Obama promised to make net neutrality a priority on the campaign trail back in 2007. And he appointed Tom Wheeler as FCC chairman and, in fact, has to appoint all of the FCC commissioners. So there is definitely a public and a political role there for the administration to play as well, even if they don't have a direct role or a hand on the legal process as we move through that this summer.
Matt Wood, you've provided much useful information for us today, and we thank you for that. We will be sure to refer our listeners to freepress.net. Thank you so much for being with us.
Yes, it's always a pleasure, and thanks for having me on again and talking about these incredibly important topics.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.
Oh yeah, praise, I got the job on you. I say, I praise the job.